Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At the end of this year, December 31st, the UN mandate governing the U.S. military presence in Iraq runs out. The Bush administration has committed to a new bilateral legal framework, a status of forces agreement, like the United States has with Japan and Germany and many other countries around the world. Trouble is, the whole thing has become a big political hot potato in Iraq, and many in Washington aren't sure they want George W. Bush negotiating the future of American commitments in Iraq. And the clock is ticking. This hour On Point, big questions on the legal framework for the status of U.S. forces in Iraq. And who do you want making U.S. commitments in Iraq now? Joining me first today from Baghdad is Alyssa Rubin, Deputy Baghdad Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Alyssa, it's good to talk with you again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Alyssa, explain to us, the United States has been in Iraq under a UN mandate for a long time now, 5 years. Why has this suddenly become front and center, a status of forces agreement, a new strategic framework? Why has the focus moved to establishing this kind of agreement?
Well, the Iraqis have really wanted to sort of get out from under the UN mandate. They feel that they're a sovereign country now. They should be making decisions about what any other forces do on their soil. They don't need the United States the way they did earlier in their in the post Saddam era. And so they would like a what they would call a normal, the kind of normal agreement that America has with other countries in terms of forces, in terms of their relationship in general.
But the Iraqis now appear to be pushing back. The prime minister in Jordan last week saying we're at an impasse. They want things we don't want. We want things they don't want. What's going on there?
Right. Well, I think here's the situation. In order for American troops to operate here in Iraq, They have to have some sort of authority to do that. Currently, they are under the UN authority. Now, the Iraqis want to end that, and there's a pretty broad agreement that it's kind of coming to a close. So the UN would have to do something at the end of this year, no matter what. Now, what the Iraqis would like is no more UN mandate and to have as I said, an agreement directly with the United States, mm-hmm. essentially a bilateral agreement. Now, as they began to negotiate that, the terms on which they want that agreement and the terms on which the U.S. want that agreement are somewhat different. There are about four or five, depending on how you want to count them, different issues that are quite significant that the Iraqis and the U.S. differ on.
Alyssa, can you tell us? Can you outline for us what the U.S. first put on the table and how Iraq responded to it?
Well, initially there was discussion, at least. It's unclear exactly how formal it was, about the U.S. wanting to have bases here. They're described as permanent bases, but I think that's a bit of a misnomer. I mean, there are bases we have all over the world that are, they consider them temporary bases, but they've been there for, you know, decades. It's hard to say what a permanent base is. But in any case, they wanted permanent bases. They wanted to have both American soldiers and American contractors not be held accountable under Iraqi law, but be held accountable only under U.S. law. This is a huge bone of contention with the Iraqis who feel that often both soldiers and especially security contractors shoot and injure people or injure Iraqis sort of cavalierly, and they want to be able to have them, to bring them to trial in Iraqi courts. The U.S. has had refused that. Then they also wanted to be able to have control of Iraqi airspace, and they wanted to be able to deploy wherever they would felt they needed to in order to go after insurgents.
They here, being now, the United States, to have commitment to deploy freely without Iraqi oversight and to have full control of Iraqi airspace. How has Iraq responded, and is there a new position?
Well, yes. And I mean, Iraq responded that it wanted changes on all of those points. They've now been or have been discussing different aspects of it. A key issue also, which I didn't mention, is detention. Should the U.S. continue to have the right to detain Iraqi citizens and then hold them in detention? And what should they do with those that they are currently holding? The U.S. currently has 20,000 plus detainees. Iraqi detainees, you know, who should hold them going forward after December 31st. So there are these issues. The Iraqis didn't really agree with any of those. They want more control over deployment. They want the control of their airspace. They wanted to be able to bring people to trial, bring contractors and soldiers to trial in Iraqi courts. What the U.S. has agreed to is that contractors would not have immunity. They could be brought to account. Detention, I think also they're willing to work out an accommodation with the Iraqis. The Iraqis would have authority over detention, both who's detained and the people who they currently have in detention. Mm-hmm. But exactly how that works is still muddy to me. I'm not sure that there's really any final agreement on that. There's not yet a final agreement on deployment. There are a lot of possibilities being discussed. But the Americans, I think, feel it's difficult to do the kind of quick response that the Americans want to do and clear it through an Iraqi system in time to also, you know, get to whatever the spot is and apprehend the people that they're going after.
And Alyssa, what about
practical problems?
Yeah, what about bases? The number of 58 bases or something like that,
right,
appeared to be on the table. Is the U.S. still asking for that?
I think that they've moved back from that, and they're not talking about it in quite those terms, but we haven't seen the language. This is all being negotiated secretly, so it's very difficult to know what exactly these drafts say. And also, since they change quite frequently, that also makes it difficult. But it sounds as if the Americans are willing to cede some ground on the bases, but it's hard to tell if what they are going to cede is more semantic than real as a practical matter. So I think we're going to want to see the language on that.
What about, if I may ask you, Alyssa, what about commitments?
Sure.
Is the U.S. making some kind of commitment to Iraqi security here? We had the foreign minister of Iraq in Washington this week, and it appears from his conversations there that there was a commitment that they're trying to put to sort of make some wiggle room in the language, not that we'd come to the aid of Iraq if it were attacked, but that we'd help out Iraqi forces. What's that about?
Well, I think that's really about the U.S. politics in part and whether congressional approval is needed. It's a matter of whether the U.S. is protecting Iraqi troops or whether they're protecting the country and what the particulars are of that arrangement.
We're protecting the country, that looks like a treaty, and that needs maybe Senate approval. But
right, and that might need Senate ratification, mm-hmm, or advice and consent. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. And so they sounds like they're trying to reword that. But whether or not the Senate will agree that they don't need to review the agreement or review the bilateral is I think still unclear. There's a feeling that this affects all of these things, affects a lot of policy
and
how troops are deployed and all of that. And so I think there may be some pushback from the Senate.
What about the politics in Iraq? You say Iraq sought this, but we see an awful lot of negative commentary coming out of Iraq about it now. Comparisons to old deals they had with the Imperial Britain and so on. How are the politics playing out?
Well, I think you have to distinguish between people wanting something that they have an ideal of in their mind, mm-hmm, and then what they're actually presented with. They want to have considerable control over the terms on which the U.S. remains in Iraq. And the U.S. wants them to have somewhat less control because they believe that a certain amount of latitude is needed in order for them to do their job, what they perceive their job to be. So this is, I think, a pretty standard disagreement between two people who have the same general general idea, which is that both would still, I mean, obviously the Iraqi government's going to be sovereign, and obviously and they still seem to want some American presence, but the exact terms of that presence is what are being debated.
Washington is still saying, President Bush is saying if he were a betting man, he'd see approval here. Washington is saying by the end of July, does that still look in the cards? And what if this isn't approved by the end of the year? What if it's not approved when the UN mandate runs out?
Well, that's a terrific question, and I think that's pretty much unanswered. There are options. You could continue the UN mandate for a 6-month period, sort of get an extension for it, if you had to. But Iraq would have to ask for that, and it's not clear to me if they would be willing to do that. I think the end of July may be optimistic. The Iraqis are really. They're very nervous about agreeing to something that could leave them still feeling like an occupied country with foreign soldiers running around able to do things that the Iraqis themselves don't do in terms of, say, detention. They're also very worried about the effect on neighboring countries. Iran has been very negative about the agreement. They don't want U.S. bases. They don't want U.S. soldiers near their borders. And they've been discouraging Iraq from striking a deal. So I think they're under an awful lot of pressure from different sources. Mm. And they're trying to figure out their own ability to control the country. How much can they do on their own? How much do they need the Americans for? At the moment, their forces are doing quite well. And they've had a number of negotiated sort of truces in difficult places.
Alyssa, we're about out of time here before a break. That's a great introduction. We're going to come back and talk about it. We're very grateful to you for joining us from Baghdad today to pull back the curtain. Thanks for being here.
Sure.
Alyssa Rubin, Baghdad Deputy Bureau Chief of the New York Times. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're going to go again to Baghdad in just a moment, but let me introduce first, joining us from New York, Vali Nasser. He's Adjunct Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a professor of international politics at Tufts University, author of The Shia Revival, and just back from a trip to Iraq last week. Vali Nasser, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're also joined from Arlington, Virginia, by Ambassador James Dobbins. He's Director of International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. He was President Clinton's, the Clinton administration's special envoy for Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, Kosovo, so he knows difficult spots. And he was the Bush administration's first special envoy for Afghanistan. Ambassador Dobbins, welcome back. Very good to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
If you two would be good enough to stand by for just a moment, I want to hear from an Iraqi parliamentarian and then get your view of what's going on here. We're joined right now from Baghdad by Mahmoud Othman. He's a Kurdish member of the Iraqi parliament. Mahmoud Othman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Do you think that this status of forces agreement, as it appears to be evolving, should be approved? Is Iraq needed? Is it the right thing for your country?
Well, I'm not sure about that, really. I think the ones who negotiate this, they should be very careful about it, because as I have heard from American responsibles, including President Bush, this will not be binding for the next administration. The next administration would not necessarily abide by this agreement, and it will not pass through the Congress. That means if there is an agreement, it should be for a few months only. And many people would think that we are joining the McCain campaign because we are doing this. So I don't think it will be advisable unless it passes through the Congress, and it will be also accepted by the next administration.
How is this conversation playing out politically in Iraq? Are Iraqis looking favorably upon this agreement? Does it divide up along ethnic lines? Is there widespread support or opposition to a status of forces agreement?
Well, you know, the question is there is no transparency. Transparency is very weak. That's why many people don't know anything about it. And that's why there are all sorts of rumors going around, from people who are pessimistic or optimistic, in the middle, different explanation. Iran has its own influence. and many others. So I think there should be transparency, and people should know at least about some of the basic things. Otherwise, you couldn't have a correct evaluation about it.
Iraq's parliament, as I understand it, is supposed to ultimately vote on this, to vote its approval or otherwise. As things stand now, are you inclined to vote for the kind of agreement that seems to be in the works?
Well, I think Iraqi parliament would be in the final stage when they make the agreement. Before they sign it and have the final touches, they will bring it to parliament. But I think from now, the parliament should know step by step what's going on. Because in the final version, they bring it to you, and it may be looking like a fait accompli just to sign it. So I think the best thing would be for parliament at least to know the steps which are going on, how things are going on. There are some people who know about it, but there are very few. So I think for the sake of success in this negotiation, there should be transparency. Secondly, there should be a united Iraqi position, because this is a national issue. It concerns every Iraqi. People shouldn't be divided on it, on ethnic or sectarian or party line. That's why I think the Iraqis should try to have united position so that they would have some success in these negotiations.
So far, not so easy on that front. Mahmoud Othman, Iraqi parliamentarian, joining us from Baghdad. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Vali Nasser, paint the big picture for us here. It's confusing dropping in on this from outside. There seems to be a lot of negotiation that's gone on, many points of contention. How do you see the big picture of what's unfolding here?
Well, first of all, this is probably a very good example of a big mistake in managing an important issue in Iraq by the United States. Given everything else that's been happening in Iraq, all the talk of improved security, a better circumstance, the U.S. has clearly mismanaged this process and has helped create a very different political dynamic in Iraq, a nationalist backlash that can in some ways end up being a game changer in Iraq and have unintended consequences. When I was in Iraq, we talked to a lot of politicians on all sides about this issue. And it's very clear that the Iraqi government would like some kind of a status of forces agreement that would bring him out of the United Nations supervision. But they would like to sign this in a way that their own legitimacy doesn't become sacrificed in the process. It's very clear that within Iraq, there is a sense that if this is not handled properly, the government or the politicians who sign on to this are likely to be seen as unpatriotic, as having sold the country out, and will become sacrificed. And the Prime Minister Maliki has just become much more assertive and popular because of the military operations he did in Basra and Sadr City. And he doesn't look like he would like to give all of that up by being the unpopular Prime Minister who signed away Iraq's sovereignty. And in all the discussions in Iraq, it was very clear that Iraqis look very clearly at what else has been done in this regard in the region. The Arab governments like Bahrain, Qatar, Saudi Arabia have always signed status of forces agreements that have been secret. Nobody knows what they agreed to and didn't agree to. The other cases are much more problematic. Iran signed a status of forces agreement with the United States in 1964, and that led to bloody riots in Tehran and produced Ayatollah Khomeini in the process. And in Iraq, there's a lot of talk of that. And Iraqi politicians said they remind Americans during negotiations all the time about what happened in Iran in 1964. And then there's a lot of talk about 1930s Iraq, when it looked like Great Britain gave Iraq independence and then took it away through a series of bilateral treaties. And many people look at this status of forces agreement as similar to the bilateral treaties that Great Britain had. And if you look at one of the most important figures in Iraq, the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, whose opinion matters enormously to the larger portion of Iraqi population, and is the person who's supposed to give Prime Minister Maliki the political cover for signing, has put down four conditions for this, most of which have not been met. One is that the negotiations and terms of the agreement have to be transparent, and we've heard right now on your program that they're not. That there has to be a united Iraqi front going to the negotiations table, which right now we heard is not holding. that the final result must be approved by the Iraqi parliament. And finally, that Iraq's sovereignty has to be protected. Now, the last point obviously leaves a lot of room for interpretation, but it's very clear that the Iraqi government and the negotiation process is nowhere near where these terms are. And I think there is a sense that maybe Prime Minister Maliki doesn't mind this anyways, because he really would not like to sign to this agreement right now, and he needs an excuse not to do so. And the public opinion in Iraq, Ayatollah Sistani's opinion, the mood in Iraq, provides them with ample room to tell the Americans, you know what, I just cannot do this you do better.
So the negotiation's kind of twisting in the wind there. Ambassador Dobbins, at the same time, nobody, even Barack Obama, is talking about having forces out by January 1st of 2009, as far as I know, and U.S. forces do need some kind of legal framework for their presence there. How do you interpret what's going on here, Ambassador?
Well, I think as our correspondent from Baghdad indicated, this began as a good faith effort on the part of both the Bush administration and the Iraqi administration to put the American presence and relationship on a new footing, one that's more directly responsive to the two regimes and doesn't depend on an international mandate from New York. In the process, of course, that's exposed a number of very controversial issues, which are making these negotiations more difficult, both for the American administration, because the American Congress is posing many of the same questions that we heard from the Iraqi legislator. And in particular, on the Iraqi side, where the government obviously faces a very divided constituency and is under a number of pressures. There is a fallback that's, I think, not the optimal, not the desired outcome by either side, but is an acceptable outcome by either side, and that's simply to renew the UN Security Council mandate, which I think the Security Council will do, provided both the United States and Iraq request it to do so.
Alyssa Rubin said that would go for 6 months. Can it just be repeatedly renewed? Could it go on perpetually?
It could go on as long as both the government of Iraq and the government of the United States are agreed in requesting it, and unless for some reason one of the permanent members of the Security Council decided to veto it. But I think that's unlikely as long as both Iraq and the United States are agreed in requesting it. That won't be entirely satisfactory from the Iraqi standpoint, because it means that whatever concessions the United States has made in these negotiations, and the United States has made concessions in these negotiations, essentially disappear, and you're back to the status quo ante. On the other hand, it does have the advantage of postponing the serious negotiation until you have a new administration in Washington and one that can make longer-term commitments.
What a picture. All this happening in real time. We have a lot of listeners with questions. I want to hear more from the two of you as well, but let me go to Bill in Brookline, Massachusetts first. Bill, you're on the air.
All right, thank you. I'm a Air Force National Guard officer.
Yes.
And this will very much affect me. I'm taking my troops in January, so after the deadline. And certainly I know for our military forces, we have to have some sort of status quo of agreement in place before we could ever do anything because of the legal limbo. We would be unable to do almost anything. And also, I think the far difference between the Iraqi laws and the U.S. laws would make that untenable. But I also believe that U.S. Contractors who are over there could fall under that same status quo agreement, some sort of UCMJ.
We heard they're likely not going to. Maybe the U.S. has backed down on that. As an Air Force officer, why do you think that private contractors should also be immune from Iraqi law?
Because they are currently in a limbo. They're currently in a legal limbo where they're under no law, and that actually makes our overall job that much more difficult because they can go over there and do almost anything without any legal reprisals. And then any time that a military contractor is subject to Iraqi law, that I think the political ramifications of that will be immense.
And if the UN mandate should just, Bill, if I may ask you, if the UN mandate should just go ahead and be extended again, is that good enough for you as an officer who will be commanding troops in the field there?
Is the UN mandate good enough? No, yeah. I think that we should have our own agreement with the country. And if we don't, then that is a fine, perfect, natural break, even a political break, given the political situation, to start addressing a troop withdrawal.
Fascinating. Officer Bill, commanding Air Force National Guard, headed to Iraq in January. Good luck to you and everyone who goes with you. Thanks for calling. Wally Nasser, there's an American military view saying we need this, and if we don't get it, maybe that's the signal to get out. Are those really, or begin planning it, thinking about it, are those, could that be, I don't know, a path out of this impasse?
Well, I really don't think that U.S. troops will be coming out of Iraq on January of 2009. I mean, this is not a realistic scenario. Nobody I talked to in Iraq, even people who were opposed to it, thought that the impasse would really mean that that the U.S. will be leaving with lock, stock, and barrel end of the year. And in fact, the Iraqis are already talking about a revised Chapter 7 mandate from the UN. And some of them see a benefit in it because one of the benefits of the Chapter 7 is that it would continue to protect Iraq against its considerable international financial debt that it had incurred during the Saddam years. But, you know, there is a different the problematic here is that there is the political cost for the Bush administration in not getting this deal in time, and the humiliation that this administration will face is far greater. Let me put it this way. In other words, the administration has to get this deal to save face and not to be humiliated.
Professor, I have to interject here to say I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yes, sir. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
But the Iraqis actually think that they could very easily get an extension and negotiate and get better deals or get a new deal, as the parliamentarian from Iraq was saying, with the next administration, and feel much more secured that they will be dealing with an administration with longer legs in terms of the time in the office. So we have to separate the fact that the Bush administration needs this. More so, I think, than the U.S. military needs this. Or the Iraqis do. I don't think anybody thinks that the impasse literally means a breakdown in January.
Ambassador Dobbins, the Bush administration needs it worse than the U.S. military? How can that be? As a matter of pride or what?
I think that may be something of an overstatement. Clearly, we need some kind of legal basis for our presence in Iraq. That legal basis can either be a U.N. Security Council resolution or an agreement by the Iraqi government. Either is, I think, from a legal standpoint, perfectly acceptable. I think the Bush administration would like to have completed these negotiations simply in order to leave a further legacy. I don't think they believe it will bind the next administration or lock them in, but it will turn over to the administration a going concern that will have one less problem to deal with. That is, the next administration won't have to negotiate a SOFA agreement. Mm-hmm. And even if they're not prepared, even if the candidates may not be prepared now to say that's a good idea, they'll probably think it's a good idea once they get in office, because it's not going to commit them to stay in Iraq. It's simply going to provide them a legal basis for doing so if they choose to do so and as long as they choose to do so. That said, I think Valley and others have indicated that there's a lot of political baggage that's now been accumulated by this negotiation that wasn't intended by either side, and it's becoming more burdensome. And in the end, both sides may simply back away from it, postpone the conclusion of the negotiations, and go back to the Security Council.
We've been joined by Ambassador James Dobbins. He was the Clinton administration's special envoy to Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, and Kosovo, was the Bush administration's first special envoy for Afghanistan. Vali Nasser is with us as well, with the Council on Foreign Relations, professor of international politics at Tufts University, author of The Shia Revival. Right now, Lou is calling from Buffalo, New York. Lou, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much for taking the call. Mm-hmm. Tom, I am just mystified with this 50-58 base idea. I mean, that to me is an outrage. I mean, there aren't even 58 training bases here for our Marines and soldiers in the United States. I mean, the cost of financing that is got to be abysmal. I mean, where are we going to, how are we going to man these? I mean, are we going to implement a draft? Are we going to recycle for 6, 7, 8 deployments?
Yeah.
The professional military that we have? Those are my questions.
Yeah,
Lou, the answer's off the air.
Great. Thanks for calling. Those numbers would catch anybody's eye, and I'm not sure what is meant exactly by bases, but this is what the reporting has said, Ambassador Dobbins. 50-plus, maybe 58 U.S. bases, facilities of some kind, were on the table. I don't know if they still are, but what's your interpretation? You hear Lou's questions. What's the U.S. pushing for there? Sounds like a big number. Why so many? For how long?
I don't think the U.S. is seeking to increase its presence in Iraq or acquire additional real estate.
So we have 50 bases there already, or points of defended presence?
We certainly have 50 places in which U.S. Mm-hmm. troops are operating and living, and maybe more. And I think we've simply identified the locations which we're currently employing and are seeking authorization to continue to employ them as long as we need them. I really think it's as simple as that. I'm sure the U.S. doesn't intend to acquire more real estate or build more facilities, but it needs authorization to continue to use and perhaps to some degree improve, but largely to continue to use the ones it's currently employing until the need to do so ceases. Nor is it asking, I'm sure, for permanent rights. It's simply asking for the right to use these facilities for the duration of the agreement, however long that is, or until they're no longer necessary, at which point the U.S. would turn the property back over to the Iraqis.
Well, Nasser, speak to that with us, if you will. American audiences listening very closely there, no doubt. I mean, they've heard the notion of 100 years thrown around. They've heard comparisons Americans have to Japan and Germany, where American troops and bases have been for many decades. There was talk that what the U.S. put forward included an American commitment to defend Iraq against foreign aggression. Iraq's Foreign Minister Hoshyar Zebari saying in Washington this week that that's now been modified, but it sounds kind of just like wiggle room language to say that instead of a blanket commitment to defend Iraq, that it would be a commitment to help Iraqi troops, which wouldn't require Senate approval as a ratification as a treaty. How do you see the depth of commitment and presence that's implicit or explicit in the language of a status of forces strategic framework agreement, Vali Nasser?
Well, I think it's an important point, and not operationally as to whether we need this many bases and for how long, but it's a political point because it goes to the size of the U.S. footprint in Iraq, where these bases would be located. And I think Iraqi opinion is divided. Within Iraq, you have those like Hoshyar Zebari who argue that the U.S. presence in Iraq ought to protect Iran against outside aggressors. And in this case, it means Turkey and Iran against invasion or encroachment by their neighbors.
Mm. I've got another guest joining us with a different perspective on the whole question. Let me turn to him right now, if I may. In Washington, D.C., we're joined by John Isaacs. He's executive director of the Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation work focuses on national security issues, Iraq, and more. John Isaacs, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
What are you seeing in this debate within each country and now internationally over the status of forces agreement proposal?
A lot of the discussion that you've engaged in to this point misses the larger framework. We're involved in a war. This is the sixth year of a war after the United States invaded Iraq.
I don't think anybody's under any illusions about that.
Right, but I think what President Bush is trying to do is extend U.S. presence indefinitely, something that presidential candidate John McCain has said. At a very minimum, if the United States is going to sign an agreement, and it's clear it's beyond a simple status of Ambassador Dobbins talks about a status of force agreement, which we signed with many countries. But as you yourself have said, there's also talk of a long-term strategic framework,
mm-hmm.
something that could bind the United States to Iraq for many years to come. At a minimum, I would say that the U.S. Congress, the United States Senate, should have a vote on ratification. I mean, it's incredible to me that the Iraqi parliament would vote, but the Bush administration is keeping this agreement from the Senate and not requiring a Senate vote. But even a preferable situation would be continuing the UN mandate until the end of the year and leave it to the next president, whether that's President McCain or President Obama, to determine what the status of U.S. forces should be long-term in Iraq.
But we're hearing that Iraq itself, the government there, asked for a move away from the U.N. mandate. That's kind of smacks of old colonial imperial era mandates. They wanted something more normalized. Is there some kind of strategic framework or status of forces agreement, even if under a President Obama, perhaps, that you would support?
If the new president accepted something and the Iraqi government agreed, I could see it. But remember, Barack Obama's promised to take U.S. troops out over a period of time, a brigade or two a month, with almost all troops out by 2010. Let the next president determine that. You talk about occupation or a colonial status. Well, in fact, that's more or less what we've had for the last 5-6 years since the United States invaded. I agree that situation should change. But the new agreement that has been outlined, at least in the press, and is with a lot of details unknown, could, in effect, maintain that colonial status for many years to come. Now, some Iraqi officials are complaining about details of the agreement, and the Iraqis face elections, and the United States faces elections. So I understand some of that is political posturing. But again, this is a decision should be left to the next president. And if there's an agreement that's going to be signed this year, certainly the United States Senate should have a vote.
You use that phrase, colonial status, pretty casually there. I mean, we do have agreements like this with other nations that nobody considers colonies of the United States.
But we're not in a war in those 100 other countries where we have agreements. We don't have 140,000 troops that are actively engaged in combat. We didn't launch an invasion of those other countries. Certainly, we've had a peaceful military presence in places like Japan, South Korea, and Germany, but that's the situation, again, where there has been peace. We have been in a war since March 2003. American soldiers are getting killed. Iraqi soldiers are getting killed. A lot of civilians are getting killed. It's a very different situation than the normal situation where you'd have an agreement just to base American troops in a country.
Let me take a call from Charleston, South Carolina, and Jim. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Good day, matter of fact. I was only calling is because I understand and agree that that there is definitely a delicate balance between the current administration and the congressional's play and the Congress's mm-hmm. play in this and mm-hmm. the need for congressional action. But on the same token, we've entered into these agreements over a period of time, and I think under an international law perspective, we have a duty to uphold and to continue to honor those agreements. When the Iraqi government has requested, and some of that, there's been some dissension, obviously, here in the recent months and years, but with the change of the tide in the war. But nevertheless, our presence is there. We've spent all this money and tax dollars. We can't say now it was a mistake, it was this. Well, it doesn't matter. The fact is we're engaged. We, as the gentleman said, we are at war and have been at war. And to have a present U.S. presence ongoing, we've been doing this since Korea and since World War II. So
yeah. Jim, let me ask you, if I may, President Bush is now on his way out. Farewell tour in Europe he's been in the midst of. Should he be the one whose administration heads up this new agreement, or should it wait to the American people vote, to somebody new is in the White House?
Well, I think that it demands immediate action, and I think that the president should have the right to continue to do whatever is necessary until he is no longer president. We can't just say, I'm going to put it on hold now because we're going to wait and see what will happen in the next election. I think that the president needs to try to do the best he can do to finish what he started.
Jim, we've got it. We appreciate your call, Father Nasser. What about it? Is there urgency to moving ahead with this kind of agreement or agreements? Could it, should it wait for a new American president? Should Congress be involved?
Well, looking at it from the Iraqi side, I think there's two Iraqi opinion here. The Iraqi government clearly views the United States as its protector against Iran, against Turkey, against internal enemies. It wants any agreement with the United States to have a commitment by the United States, which can only be vouchsafed in the form of a treaty approved by the U.S. Congress, that would continue to commit us to protecting that regime in Baghdad. The public opinion in Iraq is not there. Public opinion in Iraq is more interested in nationalism, is more interested in a roadmap for how the U.S. will actually leave Iraq. It's more interested in issues of sovereignty and the like. So I think in many ways the Iraqi government would like to get most out of the United States. It's not concerned whether President Bush signs this or President Obama or President McCain, but it wants it to be a treaty approved by the U.S. Congress that would commit the United States to protecting Iraq against Iran, against Turkey, and maintaining this government in the green zone. I think the Iraqi government may not necessarily have the support of the country itself, and it's a problem that it has to solve for itself. But I think the government we're negotiating with is going to demand much more commitment than the current U.S. administration is willing to give.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ambassador Dobbins, that's quite a picture. If indeed the Maliki government wants commitment to protect, U.S. commitment to protect Iraq from outside forces, also wants protection for its government in sort of bunkered in the green zone, is that really in line with what the U.S. needs here? And what if that is at odds with public opinion, as Vali Nasr says? He reminds us what happened in Iran next door after a comparable agreement with the Shah of Iran years ago.
I think these are all relevant considerations. I think in the end, the burden, the political burden of concluding this kind of agreement may result in the negotiations not reaching a conclusion this year. On the other hand, if they do, I think that any commitment any commitment that's implied will be of a conditional nature, and I think it'll be well known on both sides that in the absence of a congressional endorsement, which is not going to be sought or given, that commitment will be subject to the next president's review and possible alteration. On the other hand, if you're going to have an agreement that permits U.S. forces to operate in Iraq, however briefly, whether just for the 18 months that Senator Obama has sometimes talked about, you're going to need to explain why they're there. In other words, if you have a document that says that for this period you can continue to perform these functions, you need to have some sort of introductory language which explains why you're doing it and what the purpose of those functions is. And the purpose of those functions is to help the Iraqi government secure control over its territory and better protect its population. So a statement that says, here's what we have agreed that the U.S. is authorized to do, and here's why they're doing it, doesn't strike me as inherently objectionable. Now, if it goes beyond that and talks more grandiosely about a long-term defense commitment against external aggression, implying that the U.S. is going to, for some indefinite and continuous period, provide a security guarantee for Iraq, then that's clearly going to be objectionable to the U.S. Congress, among others. And so I think in the end the administration would probably pull back from trying to agreeing to that kind of language, although it's quite possible the Maliki would like it.
Of course, however they put it, it will be seen how the Iraqi public and the American public at this point, for that matter, take it. Let's get one more call. Jack, Worthington, Massachusetts. Jack, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was listening to an interview yesterday and they were talking about this agreement with the Iraqi government, and one of the big points that they were bringing up, and one of the reasons why Bush administration doesn't want to submit it to Congress, is because there are very specific details about the American oversight of the oil industry, preference of United States companies coming into Iraq for development purposes, maintaining forces in the country even beyond the next administration.
Jack, our time is short. Let's go to that point in particular. Vali Nasr, are you aware of such points in this agreement that would relate to the oil industry in particular, commercial interests?
Well, the negotiations and the agreement are not transparent, so we don't know what is in it. But I haven't heard any concern about the oil industry or contracting expressed by Iraqis I spoke to. That's not part issues that they are concerned with.
John Isaacs, we've got 1 minute. Would you propose just waiting for whoever comes into the White House next, rolling over the U.N. mandate? What's your proposal?
Absolutely. Keep the U.N. mandate in place. It's worked for more than 5.5 years. There's no reason the United States and Iraq can't continue with this agreement, and then leave it up to the next president with congressional approval. again, this president doesn't want Congress involved and would like to maintain a much longer-term presence in Iraq, which is contrary to the views of both the Iraqi people as well as American citizens.
What a picture. John Isaacs in Washington, thank you very much for being with us for the conversation today. And Ambassador James Dobbins at RAND. Thank you very much, Ambassador Dobbins, for joining the conversation.
Pleasure.
Vali Nasser in New York, just back from Iraq. Thank you so much, Professor Nasser. It's always good to speak with you. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Ping Wang, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Will Roselip, Samina Udine, and Sylvia Spring. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.